I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Bob Joseph joins me again. He has just published a new book, Indigenous Relations, Insights, Tips, and Suggestions to Make Reconciliation a Reality, written with Cynthia F. Joseph. The book is a companion to last year's best-selling and acclaimed book, 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act, which he was on this program with when it came out. In fact, we taped this interview a couple of weeks ago, a few days after that book won the Bill Duthy Booksellers Choice Award from the BC Book Prizes. In this new book, they discuss practical tools as to how to interact with Indigenous peoples, whether in business or personal interactions. I asked Bob about the difference between hereditary and elected leadership, which is something we hear a lot about in current affairs. We talk about myths and stereotypes, as well as which terms are preferable. It's a useful book, and there's lots to talk to Mr. Joseph about. Bob Joseph is the founder of Indigenous Corporate Training, which since 1994 has provided training on Indigenous relations to governments, Fortune 500 companies, financial institutions, as well as various enterprises, small and corporate. This book is published by Page Two Books. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Bob Joseph. Mr. Joseph, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk again.
Yeah, likewise.
I was at the BC Book Prize Gala this past weekend, and congratulations on a very well-deserved award for the previous book.
Wow, yeah, it was such a pleasant surprise, and, you know, it really is great to be recognized that way. It helps get the word out, and, you know, who would have thought a year ago when we last talked that a book about the Indian Act would be, you know, getting awards and recognition and be a bestseller and all kinds of really neat things.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because that book really struck a chord with readers. And so I'm wondering why do you think it did so well?
You know what, I think it was just things that people didn't know. And honestly, I didn't know if it would either. But, you know, as we talked about before, it was a blog post that I published. 21 Things You Don't Know About the Indian Act.
And, yeah.
And like yourself, just trying to get good content online for people to learn. And that blog post went crazy, 50,000, 55,000 Facebook, readers alone just from Facebook came to have a look. And that sort of told us, wow, they're interested in this. And it's striking a chord. And, and I think that's what really pushed us in the direction of publishing. It would allow us to get to a bigger audience. A big goal for me is to kind of change the world and, try to live in a country without an Indian Act designed to assimilate. And,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think people were just, surprised at some of the things and shocked. And, we still get feedback every day on Twitter and on Facebook. And, it's still kind of steaming along. It's such a great feeling.
What's fascinating about the work you're doing, and not just the work that you're doing in terms of your business and in the consulting that you do, in terms of these books, I mean, the previous book, 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act, really started, for a lot of people, framing the conversations that we need to have in our society, in our culture, in our discourse. And you're continuing that conversation with Indigenous Relations, this new book that's out now. In terms of who the book is for, I mean, is that something that you're thinking about when you're writing not only this book but the previous one, say?
Yeah, the school of thought in shameless marketing, if I can talk like one for a second, is to have a persona in mind. When you're writing, that way your message doesn't come across as mixed and scrambled.
Right.
And so, we were trying to think of how we could get to the average person. Now, this book is sort of a takeoff from our Working Effectively with Indigenous Peoples book, and we took sort of that book and 21 Things and, the new reconciliation stuff and put them all into Indigenous Relations in case there were Canadians who are wondering what to do about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and wanted to maybe get involved in helping implement the calls to action from the TRC and, of course, all of those governments and businesses and nonprofits and healthcare providers. You know, there's a truth and reconciliation call to action for every one of those, and that sort of meets all of the, or quite a large number of the calls to action. It was sort of a serendipitous in that way. We'd always been sort of teaching this stuff, but then along comes the TRC and says, here's what you should learn about. And the two just, you know, they were just so closely intertwined. So, we thought, you know, with there being so much interest around the TRC, this would be a great book for anybody interested in doing that, which would be a lot of people at this time.
Yeah. There's so much, Bob, in this book, Indigenous Relations, that I found not only fascinating and interesting, but useful. And I'll go through some of them in a sec here, so the things that interested me. But on the idea of working towards reconciliation, I mean, how important is it for all of us in this country to do that?
I think it is sort of the thing of our time. It'll really shape the country for the next, you know, whole number of generations. And I think if we get it right, it'll be actually a pretty great place for a whole bunch of reasons. If we get it wrong, then we see other places in the world where they struggle because they haven't made any efforts at reconciliation, and there's just hundreds and thousands of years of conflict and mistrust and, you know, acrimonious relationships. So I really think, you know, Canada's a great place to live and a great country, and if we can get people, you know, sort of talking and understanding each other, it can continue sort of down that road. And so I think that's why the reconciliation piece is so important, because it really is about the kids. And I think, you know, that's certainly a big motivation on my side of the conversation, making sure it continues to be a great place and people feel welcome and respected and understood and, you know, those kinds of things.
Well, what does, say, working towards reconciliation every day in our lives, say, every day, what does that look like? I mean, what's something that we can do, you know, that doesn't really change how we conduct ourselves, but I mean, can be very helpful on that path to reconciliation.
Oh man, there's so many. You know, there's you could do a pledge to personal reconciliation. You could get involved with your organization. Like I say, the calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission set out a call of action for every level of government, for nonprofits, for healthcare providers. You know, there's over 90 calls to action, and they're really accessible to sort of every sector of society. And so to get involved in that with your organization would be great. Of course, you know, if you don't want to do that, but you just want to go on a personal journey, you can learn about the history and the culture on your own. But do it with the people around you, you know. So if you're living in Haida Gwaii, learn about Haida people and Haida culture and some of their experiences with residential schools and banning of potlatches, and, you know, so they can make it much more localized that way, just in terms of reconciliation. Doing the protocol, I think one of the neat protocol examples that I saw recently was Anne Hathaway, a Hollywood actress, a star on the Walk of Fame,
right,
get a protocol piece as part of her acceptance speech, which was super cool, you know, to the Hollywood star. Certainly the Winnipeg Jets, I know, were doing it at the start of their hockey game. Ottawa Red Black on Ottawa. Ottawa Red Black, you know, I saw in a YouTube video had invited Chief White Diamond to come and do the protocol. So very small actions that can lead to, you know, really good relationship building and understanding.
For people listening to us, Bob, I think you've referred to it as a protocol. A lot of us know it as a land acknowledgement, and you write about that in the book, just how important that is, and how it's becoming. I can't think of a better term for it at the moment, but mainstream almost. It's something regular at events public events that one goes to, and it does mean a lot, doesn't it?
It does. You know, you think about things like the Canada 150. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at the history and in terms of Indigenous relations, when the 150 came out, there was some concern there from Indigenous peoples that, you know, Canada's actually been here for a lot longer than 150 years.
Yeah.
And so I was actually getting phone calls from some of our big retail clients and other clients who are saying, Bob, we really want to celebrate the 150, but we're, you know, we're concerned we might, you know, maybe it might be upsetting to the, you know, First Nations, Inuit or Métis peoples, you know, should we celebrate or shouldn't we? And my comment was, take a look at what the city of Vancouver's doing, for example. They were celebrating, you know, Canada 150, and they put just a little plus, Canada 150 plus, and that was kind of an acknowledgement in itself that they were saying, yes, Canada's been here, it's a great country, it's been around for 150 years, but then there's Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh who've been here for, you know, depending on the archaeological evidence you look at, 16,000 years, or, you know, since the very beginning, they will tell you in their creation story. So, yeah. You know, very sort of neat reconciliatory sort of action, and why land acknowledgments are important, because, it, you know, it just says there's just a little bit more history than we've sort of been taught in schools and, you know, and things in the past.
Now, in terms of the vernacular that we use, the terminology, I mean, the book is called Indigenous Relations. Is there a difference, say, between Indigenous and Aboriginal?
Yeah, there is actually a pretty big difference. So we remember back to Justin Trudeau's victory speech, and people can go, you know, Google it on YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube, you know, search YouTube, search engine, you know, Justin Trudeau victory speech. And if you watch it, about 15 minutes in, the new prime minister back in 2016 says, I want to strengthen the nation relationship with Indigenous peoples. And as soon as he said that, I looked at my wife, Cindy, who's a non-Indigenous but a lawyer by nature. I said to her, well, somebody at the Department of Justice just fell off a chair, because that's such a big change in terminology from Aboriginal peoples, which is used in Section 35 of the Constitution Act. And I said, now they're, you know, crawling on the floor to get to the phone so they can call the Prime Minister's office for first legal briefing, because they're going to want to really talk about Indigenous peoples and Aboriginal peoples. And the difference between the two, if we look at a project like a major pipeline, for example, I won't name one, there's, you know, plenty of them sort of going around, but if we want to build a big pipeline underneath sort of Canadian law, Section 35, constitutionally protected rights, interpreted law, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples can't veto the consultation. Consultation doesn't confer a veto. Where Indigenous peoples is really an international term, and that international term has a standard of consultation that says we're supposed to get their free, prior, and informed consent. Build a big pipeline or a mine or a new road or upgrade a bridge or whatever it is that we're going to do. So that was sort of the big hubbub around the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Canada was really uncomfortable signing on to the declaration. You know, way back when it was introduced, we actually we decided not to sign on it, even though we've been a part of sort of co-developing it with a bunch of other nation states around the globe. We couldn't sign on to it. We fought that for years and years and years, and finally we endorsed it with condition. And then when the Liberals and Justin Trudeau won, they said we unanimously support the declaration. So there was a lot of concern that in free, prior, and informed consent would be used as a veto to stop big development. And that was sort of the challenge of why Aboriginal peoples and Indigenous peoples are two very important words. And which one we use will be, you know, I think a function of who's governing. And but there is a lot of meaning there. So.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that one can learn about when they pick up your book, Indigenous Relations. When it comes to because we hear about it a lot in the news, pipelines and the sort, we hear of hereditary and elected chiefs or leadership. there's a difference between the two, and I'm wondering what that is.
Yeah. So one of them really was created right about the time we became a country, way back in 1867. The federal government, a new federal government, because that's when we became a country, with the British North America Act, the country was created, and Section 9124 of the British North America Act gave control over Indians and lands reserved for Indians to the federal government. So they became a federal responsibility at that time. And the idea that Canada had at that time was to assimilate, and they would use this document, the Indian Act, to help facilitate this post-Confederation assimilation policy. And one of the things that they thought would help assimilate Indians into the political and economic mainstream was we would tell them that the way they were governing themselves, like they had been for, you know, whatever amount of time, 16,000 years or 14,500 years, they were already self-governing communities. But what the federal government said was, we're not going to recognize those governments, and we're actually going to require you to elect a chief and council. So that's what a band chief is. It's somebody that's elected. Plus, we're going to speed it up, too. We don't want them to have four-year cycles. We're going to give them two-year cycles. That way they get used to having elections and, you know, going through that process. So, and you're allowed a chief and council member for every 100 members. So if you have 205 members, you got one chief and one council member. Now, they're elected by their people, but they're accountable to Indian affairs. And that's the part that bands really don't like. And when they call for self-government, it really is about sort of changing that historic relationship with Indigenous Northern Affairs Canada. And so that's the band chief. Now, the hereditary chiefs, those were the peoples that were there before. And, you know, and if we just talk about British Columbia, there's seven major language families, over 30 different dialects. And so when it comes to talking about hereditary chiefs, there's lots of different mechanisms. In some communities, their patriarchal passage of power and authority goes down through the men, and it's inherited. So I inherit from my dad, and he inherits from his. In other communities, it goes down through the women. There's matriarchs or clan mothers or aunties. Just depends on the culture and the protocol. And so those they have these, like the king and queen of England. They have these hereditary institutions, hereditary governance models, but the elected chief and council really was supposed to replace them. They were supposed to abandon those hereditary chiefs. And so that's the difference between the two. One's elected, one inherits their chieftainship following that cultural protocol, usually along the bloodline. But,
yeah. And then we see in the media when certain issues come up, very often the two are pitted against one another, right?
Yeah, very much so. And so I think we're at a neat time in Canadian history, where even the Indigenous Affairs Minister said about sort of one of the recent conflicts in British Columbia, that whole problem really exists because of the Indian Act. So you can go look for her quote in one of the local papers, and she's sort of bang on. You know, because we created these band chief systems, you know, it created problems and tensions with the hereditary chiefs, and certainly in some of the big infrastructure, it's emerged as a conversation piece. And so, you know, what she's been doing, Minister Carolyn Bennett for Indigenous Northern Affairs Canada, has been to try and tour around the country and, you know, consult and engage with communities on, you know, how do we change the Indian Act? What do we do about it? Do we keep it? Do we toss it? Do we blend it up with, you know, traditional governance? What does that look like? And so that's largely been the work of the last few years, and my understanding, it may change because we're in election time now, but so that now that we've talked about it, in the next term, if the federal Liberals are reelected, then they would start to implement, you know, some of those ideas around self-government.
Right. There's a section in the book where you talk about what people should do when they're say having a conversation with someone who's Indigenous, or they're having meetings and the sort. I found that incredibly useful, because you know how to comport oneself is always something that we should keep in mind. And you also talk about some of the annoying habits that we should avoid. Now there was something that interested me, and that's the idea of eye contact. And because when we go to meetings, we tend to think that making eye contact or expecting eye contact is important. But you write in the indigenous context, there's something that we should notice about that.
Yeah, for sure. And they're actually the noticeable piece will be most likely, but not in all cases, because again, there's over 600 different bands
across
the country, 11 major language families, 50 different dialects. But probably one of the real notable features will be the less eye contact. And it makes sense when we talk to anthropologists about indigenous cultures. They come from oral societies with oral history. So when we hear those words, we should be thinking, oh, these people are really used to doing more talking and more listening. Mm. And that we're probably not going to get as much eye contact with nodding of understanding and, you know, a lot of the verbal cues that we might get from a lot of eye contact. So I will tell, you know, people in blog posts when they're training sessions, look, don't try to expect a lot of eye, don't expect a lot of eye contact. It'll be great if you get it, but if you don't, I wouldn't worry about it because for them, talking and listening is much more important. And I've actually tried to explore the source of that, and I've heard a couple of reasons that sort of stand out. One was they weren't allowed to look at people of power and authority in residential schools. They could get into trouble for that. So there's a personal safety component to less eye contact. But I also did some work for a group of people in the Cranbrook region. We had been fortunate to have an elder sit in through the whole day, and I started talking about eye contact, and when I was done, he jumped up right away and he said, yeah, you know, Bobby's right. We did less eye contact, you know, because if I was sitting here in this interview right now with you and we're looking at each other in the eye, if we're spending all of our time looking at each other in the eye, he made a little cultural joke about it. He said, we could miss supper going by. Everybody's just like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of a hunter-gatherer and fisher society, and when they were hunting, you don't spend a lot of time looking at each other. You want to have be back-to-back and have 180 degrees kind of, you know, sort of so you could get the whole panorama instead of looking at each other eye to eye, you know, talking about whatever important subject of the day there was. So a couple of reasons for less eye contact. For sure.
Yeah. It's what's fascinating about the book, a lot of things that people will obviously learn from reading it. And some might think, Bob, that it is a lot of work, and obviously it is, but it's something that we all have to do, right?
I think it's the cornerstone just in terms of respectful relationships, and actually a lot of fun. You know, most people I meet, most Canadians, really value being able to travel and go meet other cultures and experience different things, where I think you don't have to do that at all. You can get that experience right in Canada. Just in working with the cultures that are here, there's so much we can learn. And some of it's not bad, right? You know, when I think about post-Confederation Indian policy, it was put into place on the basis that they're primitive cultures, they live short British lives, and what we have to do is make things better for them. And so just on that last comment, make things better for them. When we look at Indigenous cultures, you know, even just on the lower mainland of Vancouver and, you know, all around the lower mainland, those were fish cultures. Mm-hmm. And if we had to guess how many weeks a year they were working to get through Maslow's first two levels of the hierarchy of needs, you know, the number you should land on in your head is about less than 9 weeks a year. Mm-hmm. And so because they're able to catch as much fish as they want, there was 100 million sockeye coming to the Fraser River every year at the time of contact. That's just one species of the five or six Ankarinka species that are there. They really had a good lifestyle with artistic expression and winter ceremonials, and they weren't working really, you know, long hours and, you know, dedicating most of their lives to work. So, you know, if you ever said to my dad, and I always joke about this with our learners, if you ever said to my dad, but you live short British lives and what we were helping, try to help you make things better, he would always say, yeah, I know, I hear you, you're trying to make things better for us, but honestly, we were working less than 9 weeks a year and we weren't paying taxes, but please, tell me how what you have is better. I'd love to hear it. Well, I think we could learn from each other.
And absolutely, yeah. And that's another thing that I got out of the book. When you talk about misconceptions and myths, those are things that we need to confront on a daily basis, and whether one is indigenous or not. When you encounter something that's untrue, there is a responsibility for all of us to correct that, right?
Yeah, I think so, too. Just, you know, even if it's just to say, I'm not quite sure that's the way it actually works. And I think, you know, my buddy Doug, you know, will do that at his dinner table. He's a great guy, and he's got lots and lots of friends. And, you know, he goes to dinner parties, and they come to his place. And he'll hear them talking sometimes. And the guy will say, yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure that's not exactly the way you think it is. But, I don't want to get into it a whole bunch. But if you want, I can send you a link where you can do a little bit more learning about taxation or free housing or something like that. So I think, to not let those myths and misconceptions, you know, rule how we think about people and what we should do or not do. I think that would be not a great situation.
And it all comes down to having conversations with one another and knowing how to have them better. And that's the path to reconciliation. That's the path to a better society. And I think with this new book, as well as your previous one, you've helped a lot of people, I guess, start that conversation. And so, that's your life's work. But I don't know if you can imagine just how helpful it is for a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky because I actually asked for feedback after all of the training, and we get lots of great feedback from people. And from the blog, you know, we have over the last couple of months, we've had over 100,000 readers a month come to the blog and download, you know, 23 tips to not say and do and 27 things to say and do.
Yeah.
And so the feedback's amazing, you know, just in terms of people wanting to learn. I think that we can credit the TRC and the interest and Indigenous peoples, and give academia, K-12, college and universities, give them 15 years. This will be an amazingly different country because we're going to address the myths and misconceptions, and people will have much better information. I think I'm excited. I always tell people I'm bullish about reconciliation. I do know there's some frustration. It's not happening fast enough, and when is it going to be done? And, you know, I always tell people, look, it took us 130 years to get into the place. We're not going to get out of it in 2 years, but it will take sort of ongoing work. If we give it a chance, man, it'll really, really make it a great place for people to live and grow up in. And,
Bob, it's been great to talk again. I enjoyed this book and our chat today. My compliments to you and Cynthia. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, and thank you. Thank you very much.
The book is called Indigenous Relations Insights, Tips, and Suggestions to Make Reconciliation a Reality. It is co-written with Cynthia F. Joseph. It is published by Page Two Books. Bob Joseph joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.